We interviewed her at the Paris Climate Summit in 2015.
Well, I listened to Donald Trump saying, you know, that he doesn't believe that we've caused or are causing climate change, and some of the other right-wing leaders. And I just ask myself, do they really believe what they're saying? Because it seems so very obvious. And if you read the facts, I don't see how you can come to any other conclusion but that it's our misuse of fossil fuels, the emissions from agriculture, from industry, from households, the vast impact that's being made by this intensive farming of animals.
Jane Goodall has died at the age of 91. We interviewed her a number of times on Democracy Now!, most recently back in 2015 at the Paris Climate Summit. To see that full interview and all the others, go to democracynow.org. This coming weekend, I'll be speaking Saturday, October 4th at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco after the showing of Steal This Story, Please, a new documentary about Democracy Now!, and on Sunday, October 5th in Berkeley at BAMFA for the Q&A after. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
I'm Mr. KB of Portland, Full Strength Community Radio. This is Kabaka Pyramid representing from Kingston, Jamaica. Baby Rock family, you don't know.
Rev up your support for KBU Community Radio. Have an old car taking up space? Donate it to KBU. Your unused vehicle can become music to our ears, powering independent radio that amplifies diverse voices and community perspectives. It's easy and hassle-free. Either visit kbu.fm/cars or call 1-877-KBOO-123. You'll get a tax donation and the satisfaction of supporting local independent media. Donate your car to KBU Community Radio today and drive change in your community.
KBU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kbu.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kbu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBU comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen and provide support 24/7. Confidential support available by text or phone call to 988. More info at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBU Evening News.
Coming up in the KBU Evening News, scores improve according to Oregon education leaders, showing progress for overcoming pandemic learning losses. Oregon and Washington lawmakers are trying to help thousands of their own constituents impacted by the government shutdown, and why suicide rates are higher among senior citizens in Western states. Good evening. This is the KBU Evening News for Thursday, October 2nd, 2025. I'm Annette Newell. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Oregon's public schools are showing progress as students recover from pandemic-era learning losses. Today, State School Superintendent Dr. Charlene Williams joined Dr. Bernard Adams, the Accountability and Equity Officer, and other school system leaders to announce that the latest scores are encouraging, citing some improvements in middle school English, language arts, and math, growth in 8th and 11th grade science, and higher participation across just about every group. Here is part of what they said.
Despite all of the distractions, the noise, the impact to our community, our students in classrooms are showing growth, and we're super proud of what's happening. Because of investments from our state and the dedication of our teachers, our support staff, and our leaders, we saw growth in all subject areas across our district, and we are excited to talk about those numbers. Here with me, I have Dr. Adams.
I wanted to share a few data highlights that show that we're headed in the right direction, and yet we know that we still have more work to do. Overall, PPS students in the 3-8 grade band saw a year-over-year increase of 1.5 percentage points in English language arts and an increase of 2.0 percentage points in mathematics. When we look at our racial student groups across the 3-8 band overall, all racial student groups saw both gains in ELA and mathematics. As we look at grade 3-5, grades 6-8, grades 3-8, PPS year-over-year changes were positive in all grade bands except for our Latinx students in elementary school, where there was a decline of 2.4 percentage points. In mathematics, there's a similar story. Our Latinx students in elementary school saw a slight decline. Students receiving special ed services saw increased performance in the middle grades band, and when we look at their performance over grades 3-8, with grades 3-5 remaining relatively flat. In mathematics, students with disabilities showed increased performance across all of the grade bands, so we're proud about that. Our one-year achievement changes were positive in most individual grade levels. In ELA, students in grades 4-8 showed the most growth with 3.4 and 4.1 percentage point gains respectively. In grades 3-5, we saw small declines of 0.9 percentage points and 0.1 percentage points. And in mathematics, the only decline was in grade 3 with 1.2 percentage points, while the strongest growth in mathematics was in grades 7 and grades 8, where we saw 3.2 and 5.2 percentage points respectively. What I'm getting really excited about, beyond what I've just shared with you, is the fact that we're now exceeding pre-pandemic achievement levels in mathematics, and we're just about there in English language arts. We're just missing that mark of meeting our pre-pandemic performance by 0.5 of a percentage point. I'd like to shout out to some individual schools. We have several elementary schools that showed positive gains in ELA and mathematics at the same time. I would have you here all day if I named all of them, so I'm just going to pick on a select few. And those elementary schools include Glencoe, Lee Elementary, Markham, and Wrigler, just to name a few. And we also had some middle schools that showed the same achievement, where they showed growth in English language arts and mathematics. And those include, and we could spotlight, Harriet Tubman Middle School, Hosford Middle School, Beaumont, Kellogg, and Roseway Heights. While we are pleased with this progress, we know we still have persistent gaps along the lines of race and ethnicity. We know that we have more work to do, and we believe we're on the right track. We know our students are capable, our educators and building leaders are so very talented and skilled, and that we know our families are ready and willing to partner with us to reach our goals.
So it's clear from our boardroom to our classroom, we have individuals that are focused on the rise of students and intent on making sure that all of our resources and support are directed in our classrooms where it is needed most.
I know that we want to make sure that our Latinx students and our multilingual learner students, our students that don't speak English as a first language, are showing improvement. We use data as a flashlight to let us know where we need to examine, and the teaching and learning team is doing just that work. We're working on an integrated model for teaching students whose language isn't, for first language isn't English, that will involve more collaboration between teachers of those students and our general education teachers. We know that there's a color line. The browner the student, it appears wherever I've been, the less likely they are to be close to academic justice with their white peers. And so what we continue to do is work on our racial equity work, helping staff through training understand where their biases may be. And we continue to insist that everybody hold themselves and every student to high expectations. It's inside out work. There isn't a boxed thing we can implement that's going to absolutely change that. It's individual work at the individual teacher level, at the building level, at the central office level, to really get in a stance where we know our students are capable and we know we're capable of getting them where they need to be. I believe we see the most room for improvement for our COVID babies as they matriculate through school. We're trying to do a lot of academic recovery. That's why we continue to provide summer acceleration programming and things like that for targeted students. It's also why we made an investment investment in teacher interventionists at middle and elementary grades, where we saw students, those positions were allocated to schools where we saw students that had the most need. So where we understand that we have some challenges, we understand that our COVID babies are coming to us with more screen time sometimes than teacher time, and we're working to try to close those gaps. What I'm excited about is districts across Oregon and across the country are trying to get back to where they were pre-pandemic, and we're doing that here in Portland. So I'm excited about that. That's not me saying that pre-pandemic performance was enough. It's me saying it's a bar that we're all across the nation trying to get back to show some academic recovery. We followed their framework for accountability, which comes first from the federal Every Student Succeeds Act and flows down through the ODE. And so we have a lot of leeway in how we do it within some guidelines. They don't tell us what curricula to use or for our teachers to use. They do ask us, however, to revise and bring in curriculum on a cycle. And so we work within the bounds of all the Division 22 ODE requirements to make sure we're providing quality education programming for students across PPS. So I would like to invite Dr. Isaac Cardona, our Chief of Schools, to talk about the professional learning work that we're doing.
So we already begun to highlight some of the work that we've seen. The principal of Harriet Tubman got to lead some professional learning at our back-to-school leadership for principals. And so highlighting the work that they were doing, both with the instructional leadership teams and coaching and developing teachers. So it's been very exciting to learn from folks that are already seeing great gains over the course of the past year. And we're keeping that going. So every month we pull together principals to be in each other's buildings and learning best practices. And then from there, they go back and incorporate those into their own classrooms.
Southern Oregon is rebuilding smarter after the devastating wildfires in 2020. About 8,500 people were displaced after the Alameda fire, but now the towns of Talent and Phoenix are mostly rebuilt, with a focus on energy efficiency and fire resiliency. Isabel Charlet has the story.
5 years after the Alameda fire destroyed more than 3,000 homes and businesses in Southern Oregon, the cities of Talent and Phoenix are prioritizing energy efficiency, affordability, and wildfire resilience as they rebuild. Phoenix worked with Energy Trust of Oregon to build a new energy-efficient public safety building to replace facilities lost in the 2020 wildfire. The 20,000-square-foot hub houses city offices, police, and fire services. Phoenix City Manager Eric Swanson says with the help of local, state, and federal partners, the city has been able to make the best out of a tragic situation.
We've been able to take advantage of a lot of energy efficiency initiatives in our building, which I think has really set us up well for the future. We're planning for the worst, hoping for the best.
The building's energy efficiency measures, including efficient lighting, HVAC systems, and stormwater management, are expected to save thousands of dollars annually. Swanson says residential construction in the city is largely complete, although rebuilding of mobile homes and commercial buildings has been lagging behind. Talent, Oregon is just south of Phoenix and lost 700 homes in the fire. Michael Hoke with Energy Trust of Oregon helped with the rebuilding process there.
We'd lost 40% of our town. That building stock was a lot built in the 60s or the 70s. How do we encourage people to build more resilient, to build with energy efficiency top of mind?
He says the city partnered with Energy Trust to create the Energy Performance Scores Rebuild Program, which incentivizes wildfire victims to rebuild their homes to be more energy efficient and wildfire resistant. He adds residents are happy with the results.
It's always lovely getting a text from one of them saying, hey, I'm not paying any energy because I'm producing more solar energy than I'm consuming. Or, hey, my energy bill is still pretty low.
For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
As the federal government shutdown continues, leading lawmakers in Oregon and Washington are speaking out. Here's Oregon Congresswoman Andrea Salinas.
Why did they shut it down? They shut it down because Democrats were insisting on lowering the cost of health care. They were insisting that Republicans reverse the dirty cuts to health care cuts in premiums under the Affordable Care Act, and they were asking to save health care. That's why they shut down the federal government. We won't stand for it. We're asking for Republicans to make sure that Americans and Oregonians have the health care that they need. 16,000 Oregonians just in my district are at risk of seeing price increases, premium increases to their health care of over sometimes 500%. These are astronomical. People can barely afford their health insurance right now. You think 500% increases in premiums is going to make it more affordable? No. All we're asking for is for Republicans to come to the table to work with us to bring the cost of health care down. They said no. Instead, they said, let's shut down the government. Let's shut out the American people. Let's stay on vacation. This is unacceptable. I'm here to get work done for the people in Oregon, for the people across America.
And another Oregon congresswoman is promising that she'll do everything she can to help her constituents impacted by the government shutdown, estimated to affect thousands of Oregonians. At her telephone town hall, Maxine Dexter predicted that the shutdown would start hours before it actually did, and she had a message for local people worried about the impact.
I have prepared resources with my team to make sure that you can plan and understand how it may impact you and your family. You can find those on our website, dexter.house.gov.
The Democrat says she and her party still want a solution but have different priorities than the Republicans.
Republicans are in charge of the House, the Senate, and the White House. And Democrats are in D.C., ready and willing to vote on a funding bill that protects health care, lowers costs for our families.
Callers told Congresswoman Dexter they're concerned about President Trump's promise of federal troops on Portland streets.
The speech that Trump gave to the military, specifically, he stated that we are under invasion from within, and the cities are a military training operation.
That is so egregious. Number one, he is absolutely going against the Constitution when he is using U.S. military forces against our own citizens. There is no invasion. There is no rebellion. There is no lack of ability for our federal officers or federal laws to be enforced. And so him saying that it's a nightmare and that it looks like World War II in Portland, like whatever he is watching or being shown is not consistent with reality.
That was Oregon 3rd District Congresswoman Maxine Dexter, and another Pacific Northwest leader, Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray, spoke out from the Senate floor.
It is already painfully clear that Republican leadership is not taking any of this seriously. Republican leadership doesn't care if millions of Americans lose their health insurance. Republican leadership does not care if your health care costs go through the roof. And despite a lot of showboating, Republican leadership obviously doesn't care how long this shutdown goes on. Just consider, if Republican leadership and President Trump actually cared about reopening the government, Trump would not be tweeting AI deepfakes and mariachi music, or bragging about how he can't wait to use a shutdown as an excuse to inflict more pain on the American people. If they actually cared about reopening the government, Russ Vogt wouldn't be saying he'll fire everyone he can, no matter if firing them is necessary or not, and no matter how harmful it is or not. If they actually cared about reopening the government, Republican leaders would not be pressing ahead with the same failed bill and refusing to finally work with Democrats to finalize a solution. If Republican leadership actually cared about reopening the government, House Republicans would actually be here. Let me say that again. House Republicans are not even here. Are we supposed to believe they are taking this seriously? I guess not. And if Republican leadership actually cared about reopening the government, they would be talking with us about how the actual issues we want to address, how to stop skyrocketing health prices, hospital closures, millions of patients from losing their health insurance. Instead, they are screaming illegal immigration and telling bold-faced lies about Democrats' proposal to try and talk about anything but health care. That really gives away the game Republican leaders are playing with the American people, doesn't it? Democrats want Republicans to sit down at the table for a serious negotiation about really serious issues. But Republican leadership is off playing make-believe in la-la land. How are we supposed to negotiate with President Trump when he's busy frying his mind in an AI fantasy world of mariachi bands and science fiction med beds and who knows what next? And how are we supposed to negotiate with Republican leaders when they are refusing to work on a bipartisan path out and just making lies up about our Democratic proposal? For everyone who's only heard the Republican nonsense, let me make our agenda clear. Here's what Democrats actually want to do. We want to stop your health care premiums from doubling next year. We want to stop millions of people from getting priced out of their insurance and getting sick or going without care. We want to stop hospitals from closing. I wonder why Republicans have such a hard time being honest about that. Maybe because they caused this healthcare crisis in the first place. And let's be crystal clear, it is not honest for Republicans to try and just say, oh, we can just talk about healthcare later. We pinky promise. Rate hikes are being finalized right now. Notices with massive price increases will land in our families' mailboxes this month. Open enrollment starts in a matter of a few weeks. That means families are going to start seeing their premiums double. People are going to get priced out of coverage, that is, unless we act now. There is no waiting. We have been waiting. There is no later. That is too late. Are Republicans saying they will not talk about solutions until the damage is done? Are they saying they want to lock in the high health care rates first? You know, the best time to put out a fire is before it burns down the house. Surely Republicans don't need me to tell them that. But if Republicans insist on asking why we can't address health care later, I've got a few questions for them. First off, why the heck couldn't we talk about health care sooner? Huh? Where in the world have you been? You moved heaven and earth to pass new tax breaks for billionaires by cutting over $1 trillion from Americans' health care. Why won't you move a muscle to save health care for our working families? My goodness, why is it not until there is a shutdown Republican leaders will even say we can at least talk about health care? Oh, but not yet. And if a shutdown is the first time Republican leaders will even acknowledge in the slightest whisper the looming health care crisis, why should we trust for one second you'll keep your word later? Republicans have been choosing to ignore this health care crisis for months. And now they face another choice. How much longer are they going to insist on this partisan path? How much longer are they going to stick their heads in the sand? Because I will warn them, the American people cannot wait. One family in my state of Washington is about to see their premiums jump from $283 a month to as high as $1,800 a month.
And that was Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, cloudy with a slight chance of rain, a low around 50. Tomorrow's weather, sun and clouds mixed, a high of 68. Today in history, on this date in 1967, Thurgood Marshall was sworn in as the first black justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. The quote of the day is from Marshall. None of us got where we are solely by pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. We got here because somebody, a parent, a teacher, an Ivy League crony, or a few nuns, bent down and helped us pick up our boots. Gun suicides among people age 70 and older rose dramatically between 2003 and 2023. It's a trend that's highest in Western states, including Idaho, as Eric Tegedoff reports.
Data compiled by the Gun Violence Data Hub finds Idaho's gun suicide rate for people aged 70 and older was more than 22 per 100,000 residents between 2009 and 2023, the fourth highest rate in the nation. The research also finds that gun suicides among this population has increased dramatically between 2003 and 2023. Aaron Mendelson with the Gun Violence Data Hub and a data journalist for The Trace says the research shows a clear geography for this issue.
It's quite often in Western states, places like Idaho, rural Colorado, Montana, New Mexico, that see the highest rates of this. And some of my sources said there is kind of the frontier mentality, the pick yourself up by your bootstraps, take on everything by yourself.
The research shows rural areas have the highest gun suicide rates for older Americans, and people over the age of 70 have the highest rate of any age group. Gun suicide kills more men 70 and older than car crashes, researchers found. White men over 70 are far more likely to die by gun suicide than any other group, with rates 3 times higher than Latino or black men and 15 times higher than white women. Mendelson notes there are many reasons for the high suicide rate among older people.
There's no one thing, but we're talking about factors like severe physical illness, pain, financial pressures, isolation, often the death of a spouse, a lack of mental health care, and the availability of firearms. These are all things that play a role, experts say, in these high rates of suicide among our older neighbors.
Mendelson says one of the most impactful interviews he did was with a woman who lost her husband to gun suicide in 2019.
She said that suicide when she was younger was something that was kind of hidden and that we didn't talk about it, and that things aren't going to get better unless we talk about it.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
As the federal government shutdown continues, states dip into their coffers to keep programs running, and veterans face challenges accessing services. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2025 Talks.
We can do things during the shutdown that are irreversible, that are bad for them and irreversible by them, like cutting vast numbers of people out, cutting things that they like, cutting programs that they like.
President Donald Trump says his administration is prepared to cut benefits and permanently fire large numbers of federal workers if the government shutdown doesn't end soon. Democratic critics say he has no more power to do those things now than he did before. Day one of the first shutdown in 7 years ended in impasse with competing budget bills failing in the Senate. Democrats are taking a hard line, demanding the renewal of pandemic-era supports for Affordable Care Act health insurance policies. The GOP wants to pass a stopgap at current levels and discuss health care later. Polls show Americans are generally split on who's to blame, though slightly more hold the Republicans responsible. Senate Majority Leader John Thune says Democrats' demands are not the way to address health care issues and accuses them of exploding federal spending.
Senate Democrats are demanding $1.5 trillion in partisan spending to keep the government open for 7 weeks. They are demanding more than the defense budget in their resolution to keep the government open for 4 weeks.
Observers argue he's taking the figures out of context. Federal data shows the debt grew more than $2 trillion in the fiscal year that just ended, and the Republican mega bill will add another $4 trillion to the debt over a decade, most of it going to tax cuts for the wealthy. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says Democrats must use the leverage they have now while they have it.
Republicans have tried to stick us with a partisan CR that fails to protect Americans' health care and does nothing to fix the health care mess that they created. It has now failed twice to get enough votes in this chamber, so Republicans need to negotiate with us.
The Democratic plan would also reverse some non-health care cuts in the One Big Beautiful Bill and the separate reconciliation bill. Another part would rein in the president's ability to refuse to spend money Congress has appropriated, which the Trump administration tried to do with billions in foreign aid. States with large U.S. government footprints are already implementing plans to help federal workers and maintain programs. Maryland Governor Wes Moore says state agencies will ensure federal programs there will continue operating, state employees funded by D.C. will still be paid, and state-administered federal benefits will keep supporting families. But Moore says this can't go on forever.
The longer this unnecessary federal government shutdown goes on, the harder it is for us to keep services going. We will continue to monitor the situation closely, and we will adjust accordingly.
Though many federal offices will shutter or have employees work without pay, some services are continuing. Veterans Affairs hospitals and clinics are still open, with almost all the staff showing up. But Veterans Affairs Secretary Doug Collins says VA operations, notably in counseling, disability services, and veteran readiness and employment, will be impacted.
Where it's going to be affecting us, especially in the short run, is our regional offices for disability claims. New claims are getting questions answered are going to be closed. Our counseling, our VR&E issues where people get their voc rehab, how they get into new careers, those are going to be limited. Our outreach is going to be limited.
The White House says it's withholding $18 billion in funding for New York City transit projects, two of the nation's largest. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
A Sioux tribe president slams Hegseth for the Wounded Knee Massacre decision. The Belfast City Council approves an historic indigenous language policy. And Cherokee Nation hosts a private screening of How to Train Your Dragon. Here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
The president of the Oglala Sioux Tribe has denounced the decision by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth not to revoke medals awarded for one of history's most infamous massacres. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire has more.
In late December 1890, members of the 7th Cavalry attempted to disarm a large group of Chief Spotted Elk's followers they had encircled at Wounded Knee Creek, South Dakota. A shot went off, and the soldiers mowed down the group of largely Native women, children, and elders with rifles and powerful Hotchkiss guns. 25 soldiers were killed by friendly fire as well. Later investigations showed fleeing survivors were chased down and killed where they stood. The following year, 20 U.S. soldiers received the Medal of Honor for gallantry at Wounded Knee, but top brass, including Major General Nelson A. Miles, condemned the incident as, quote, the most abominable military blunder and a horrible massacre of women and children. Efforts to revoke the medals gained momentum starting in 1990, the centennial of the incident. But in a video posted to his X account last week, Secretary Hegseth said the 20 soldiers who fired upon the Lakota natives will not have their medals revoked.
We're making it clear that they deserve those medals. This decision is now final, and their place in our nation's history is no longer up for debate.
We'll continue to fight to get these medals rescinded.
Oglala Sioux Tribal President Frank Starr comes out as a descendant of Spotted Elk and a Marine veteran of the Gulf War and Mogadishu. He says he's not surprised by Hegseth's decision, but it still speaks to the indifference of those who don't know their history.
It's despicable, it's untruthful, and insulting to our people.
In a press release, the Oglala Sioux tribe says descendants of those scarred by Wounded Knee have served honorably in every U.S. conflict from World War I to Afghanistan. And every year, an annual memorial ride is held to honor those killed at Wounded Knee. Again, Frank Starr comes out.
This is history. This is something that our people are traumatized with, and we have to live with that. And I keep saying this every time I go to Washington to advocate, not only for the Oglala Sioux tribe, and tribes nationwide. You know, we were never dealt a fair hand.
Meanwhile, the National Congress of American Indians has also denounced Hegseth's decision and are calling on the U.S. Congress to pass what's called the Remove the Stain Act, so that, quote, the nation's highest honor fulfills its namesake by reflecting courage, not cowardice and cruelty. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Belfast City Council in Ireland approved a historic policy for the island's indigenous language, as Sean McPullen reports.
Belfast City Councillors approved the new Irish language policy this week. It comes after years of advocacy and consultations with the indigenous language community. The city plans to redesign its logo to now include the original Irish spelling of Bailfirstia, which means mouth of the sandbank ford. The policy also pledges to ensure all city signs contain both languages. Far-right councillors tried to block the new policy, but were unsuccessful. The council previously earmarked the equivalent of $2.5 million to fund the changes, as well as new initiatives that remove barriers for the use of Irish in public life. The Irish language has been experiencing a renaissance of late, particularly among young speakers, in part thanks to the worldwide success of the Belfast band Kneecap. For National Native News, I'm Sean McPullen in Ireland.